This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman for a suite of professional-grade products from Protocol for Life Balance, which play a central role in helping support optimal immune function. MyCell Immune Plus, Vitamin C 1000 Plus Zinc 15, and Vitamin D3 in a variety of potencies and delivery systems, liquid, chewable, and soft gels. They're only available from healthcare practitioners, but they're available to you at drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. That's drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance for more information and to order.
Welcome to Intelligent Medicine. Thank you for joining me. I'm Layla Mutin, your host, and I'm accepting questions at radioprogram@AOL.com. Also, any topics of interest you'd like to hear meet us, that would be radioprogram@AOL.com. So, email me. If you'd like to make an appointment to have a consult with me, call our office, 212-779-1744. Again, it's 212-779-1744. If you'd like to come in, we're in Midtown, 685 Madison Avenue. At Madison Avenue between 59th and 60th. So give us a call. And I'm going to take a question now from Adilia. It's regarding the flu vaccine. Hello, Layla. I have an active hypothyroid. Adilia has hypothyroidism for about 20 years. I have always been afraid to get the flu vaccine because my original endocrinologist advised against it because I have an autoimmune condition. So you have Hashimoto's, Adilia. If it's autoimmune hypothyroidism, it's likely Hashimoto's. Can you be so kind as to give me your advice on this matter? Adilia, thank you for your question. And this question comes up a lot in our practice for Dr. Hoffman and myself. Should I get the flu shot? Shouldn't I get the flu shot? I will tell you this, that the flu shot can spur the immune system. It is meant to. It is meant to irritate the immune system enough or to wake it up, to shake it up, in order to respond to the vaccine itself, so you can build up antibodies and all of that. That's how it's supposed to work. Now, anybody with an autoimmune condition, while it's spurring up the immune system, while it's activating the immune system, it also may be activating autoimmunity. In fact, according to a medical conference I went to several years ago with Dr. Susan Blum, that's Susan, B-L-U-M, Blum, she's in Westchester County, New York. She advised that if you do have an autoimmune condition, or even if you don't, after vaccination, you should wait at least 2 months, maybe 3 months, before having any blood testing done for ANA. ANA stands for anti-nuclear antibodies. It's one of the tests that practitioners use to determine if there is any kind of autoimmune process or condition going on that needs to be looked at. It's anti-nuclear antibodies because of what the vaccine can do. So if you get, say, a flu vaccine and then you get an ANA blood test and it comes up positive, it could be a false positive because you just had a flu vaccine. You may have to wait a few months, and this is according to Dr. Susan Blum. This is important information. I would advise you, Adilia, to get your doctor's opinion on whether you should get a flu vaccine or not. That's really the person to ask, and that's what I tell anyone who is asking me whether they should get a flu vaccine or not. I tell them, in the setting of autoimmunity, what a vaccination may do, and to discuss that with their doctor. This is about informed consent. And see what your doctor has to say about it, and then go with that advice. That's what I would do. That's what I would do. Dr. Hoffman himself, and he said it many times on this podcast and elsewhere, that he's an agnostic when it comes to the flu vaccination. Okay? So, Adelia, thank you for that very, very thoughtful question. All right. And by the way, anybody with hypothyroidism or autoimmune hypothyroidism like Hashimoto's disease, generally your doctor or endocrinologist may want to see you once every 6 months or have you tested, have your thyroid function tests done, blood testing for your thyroid function, your TSH, T4, T3, every 6 months, some say every year, to make sure if you're taking any thyroid replacement therapy, whether it's Synthroid, Cytomel, Armour Thyroid, Naturethroid, Biothroid, anything else, levothyroxine, all of the above, to make sure that your dosing is current and that's where it should be, because that can change under circumstances. So, Adelia, thank you for that very, very thoughtful question. Moving on, sleep duration and quality can influence your health. No kidding, right? I've talked about sleep a lot. I've talked about sleep hygiene a lot, especially on this podcast. In 2017, sleep scientist Matthew Walker, author of the book Why We Sleep, made the assertion that humans are the only species who deliberately deprive themselves of sleep for no apparent biological gain. Although many people consider short sleepers productive members of society, the harmful consequences of sleep deprivation have been detailed in clinical studies. This is coming from the Institute for Functional Medicine. Hey, I remember, you know, being a teenager or in my 20s or something and talking amongst my friends, my peers, even my cousins. Oh, I barely got any sleep last night. I was out so late and I still got up and I made it to class. I made it to work or whatever, right? Remember things like that? Anyway, now in the most dramatic cases, prolonged sleep deprivation may lead to death. For example, rats kept awake develop a peripheral syndrome characterized by increased metabolic rate and decreased body weight, leading to death after 2 to 4 weeks. Prolonged sleep deprivation is also fatal in humans, who die after developing a similar syndrome to those seen in rats. What remains unclear, according to this, is whether death is due to loss, if death is due to the loss of sleep itself, or to other factors involved, such as forced arousals and resulting stress on the body. So, whether or not sleep loss itself is lethal, sleep deprivation in humans alters multiple aspects of behavior and physiology, including the cardiovascular system. In the United States, adults who are short sleepers, and that means less than 7 hours a night in a 24-hour period, are more likely to report a variety of chronic health conditions compared to those who did get enough sleep, greater than 7 hours in a 24-hour period. Heart attack, coronary heart disease, stroke, and diabetes are among the adverse cardiometabolic risks of short sleep deprivation. Data from 487,200 adults aged 30 to 79 years found that individual and coexisting insomnia symptoms are independent risk factors for cardiovascular disease incidence, particularly among young adults or adults who have not developed hypertension. Okay, in this cohort, researchers tracked participants for nearly a decade, and participants who reported experiencing all three insomnia symptoms, that's problems falling asleep or staying asleep, waking too early, or struggling to focus during the day because of disrupted sleep, had an 18% increased chance of developing cardiovascular diseases compared with those who did not experience these symptoms. Now, those who reported trouble focusing during the day were 13% more likely to develop heart attack, stroke, and comparable diseases than people who did not have problems focusing. Those who found it difficult to fall asleep or stay asleep had a 9% higher chance of developing cardiovascular diseases, while those who woke up too early were 7% more likely to experience a stroke, heart attack, or a similar event. So the results suggest that identifying insomnia, particularly in young people, may reduce cardiovascular disease later on in life. In a 2019 study, lower sleeping times and fragmented sleep. What is fragmented sleep? You know, repetitive short interruptions of sleep were independently associated with an increased risk of subclinical atherosclerosis among 3,974 study participants. Now, they used state-of-the-art imaging methods to quantify the amount of coronary calcification in these participants. They were divided into four groups: the very short sleep duration, which was less than 6 hours sleep; the short sleep duration, which was 6 to 7 hours sleep; the reference sleep duration, which was 7 to 8 hours sleep; and the long sleep duration, which was greater than 8 hours. Consistent with prior studies, participants with very short sleep duration or short sleep duration had higher prevalence of classical cardiovascular risk factors. Acute sleep deprivation and sleep fragmentation may also be associated with impaired glucose metabolism. Now, we know this. And it is well known that a close link exists between diabetes and cardiovascular disease. You've heard me say before, and if you haven't, I'm telling you, type 2 diabetes may be a form of coronary artery disease. Why? Because that impaired glucose metabolism, which is a hallmark of type 2 diabetes, causes the progression of coronary calcification as much as 70% faster than those individuals who don't have diabetes. So, in a 2019 study, both diabetes and hypertension were more common in the group sleeping fewer than 6 hours per night, but neither blood pressure nor glucose metabolism was assessed with sufficiently comprehensive measures to explore these factors as potential effect mediators. So this needs a little further scrutiny, right? However, insomnia itself is associated with increased risk of vascular disease, like secondary to increased sympathetic nervous system activity and dysregulation of that activity, especially of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, the HPA axis, which is so important. So researchers speculate that the disorder, obstructive sleep apnea, was a likely cause of sleep fragmentation in this sample. Now, you know about obstructive sleep apnea. Cardiovascular disease remains a highly prevalent cause of sickness and death worldwide, and accumulating evidence suggests that sleep disorders like sleep apnea may be associated with the development of a range of heart diseases. We already know that sleep apnea is associated with causing hypertension. Not only do adults with obstructive sleep apnea have an increased risk of developing comorbid cardiovascular disease, many also experience worse outcomes. Now, OSA, obstructive sleep apnea, we're calling it OSA, is highly prevalent. It's estimated to affect 40 to 60% of U.S. patients with cardiovascular disease. You know, that's significant. And you know what causes sleep apnea? Oftentimes, it's obesity. This prevalence is also increasing, with these figures representing a 30% increase over the previous two decades. Ha! And you know, overweight and obesity rates have also been rising in that time frame. And what I just said, researchers speculate that this may be related to the obesity epidemic, as well as an aging population. True. A recent analysis of the global prevalence of and burden of obstructive sleep apnea, OSA, estimated that 936 million males and females ages 30 to 69 years have mild to severe OSA, and 425 million have moderate to severe OSA globally. The prevalence was highest in China, interesting, followed by the United States, Brazil, and India. Furthermore, it's been estimated that 82% of men and 93% of women with moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea remain undiagnosed. A 2018 meta-analysis found that OSA was associated with a significantly increased risk of major adverse cardiovascular events, including all-cause or cardiovascular death, myocardial infarction, which is a heart attack, stroke, repeat revascularization, and heart failure. But while multiple cardiovascular disease processes are associated with OSA, the relationship with hypertension has been most clearly established. Metabolic dysregulation is considered by some researchers as an underlying mechanism of OSA, which often leads to cardiovascular disease. Typically, patients with OSA have greater levels of endothelin and lower levels of nitric oxide than healthy sleepers, which may explain why they often experience greater blood vessel constriction. If you don't make enough nitric oxide, you don't have enough vasodilation. This is what helps the vasculature, the arteries relax to help lower blood pressure. We count on nitric oxide for that. So, this is all interesting stuff. So, let's talk about anxiety and depression. When anxiety and depression start to negatively affect sleep patterns, this may also have a detrimental effect on heart health. And evidence suggests that persistent anxiety and depression could also be tied to negative long-term effects on cardiovascular health and may play a major role in triggering critical cardiac events like a heart attack, aka myocardial infarction. A high level of anxiety and depression was detected in a 2019 cross-sectional study of 1,053 patients with a confirmed cardiac diagnosis. 54% met the criteria for severe depression and 19.2% for severe to very severe anxiety. Factors independently associated with both depressive And anxiety symptoms were post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD symptoms, a low level of self-esteem, high somatic symptoms, low physical and mental health component scores, smoking, physical inactivity, and longer disease duration. And, you know, in the current environment, which is shaped by COVID-19, the pandemic, many individuals have been exposed to unprecedented levels of anxiety and depression, as well as disturbed sleep, which can often lead to chronic insomnia. Pre-existing insomnia is a major risk factor for developing PTSD when exposed to a major stressor, right? It's like a trifecta. A recent study showed that PTSD symptoms were reported by 7% of Wuhan residents after the COVID-19 outbreak, women in particular. Being younger than 35 years old and following COVID-19 news updates for more than 3 hours a day was associated with elevated levels of anxiety compared with those who were older than 35 years and those who were less exposed to COVID-19 news updates. Ha! Stop watching the news, people. It's kind of a terrorist. So, hey, different types of vegetables contain different levels of protective components. Cruciferous vegetables contain are rich sources of organosulfur compounds, which are proposed to be beneficial for cardiovascular health. We're talking about cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, onions, leek, garlic, the allium vegetables. Leafy green vegetables like spinach and lettuce are a rich source of nitrate, which can help lower blood pressure, right? So it's important to be a healthy eater. Micronutrient intake has also been suggested to affect sleep patterns. Deficiencies in vitamin B1, which is thiamine, folate, phosphorus, magnesium, iron, zinc, and selenium have been associated with shorter sleep duration. A lack of alpha carotene, selenium, and calcium with difficulty falling asleep. A low intake of vitamin D and lycopene with sleep maintenance, and a low intake of calcium and vitamin C with non-restorative sleep. Protein and carbohydrate deficiencies have also been associated with shorter sleep duration. So this tells us that our nutrition is important, and it's not merely about taking some melatonin or glycine or German chamomile or passion flower or anything like that at night. It's a matter of making sure that you don't have any micronutrient deficiencies, or at the very foundation, taking a good vitamin, multi-mineral supplement, something like that, right? Important stuff. So our sleep or lack of all of the above enhances cardiovascular risk factors. It's something to watch, especially in the current climate of pandemic, right? It's important to take extra good care of ourselves during this time. I want to thank you for joining me on another edition of Layla Weighs In here on Intelligent Medicine. This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients regularly along with Dr. Hoffman. If you require a nutrition consult with me but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.